One take one on the podcast is going to get clipped out before I introduce it. That's good. All right, welcome to the Eric Anders Lang Show, everybody. We're al fresco today with none other than John Buscemi. Al fresco, what does that mean to you, John?
Well, al fresco, it sounds like you're at, you know, you're in Beverly Hills on Camden outside getting an Aperol spritz, maybe a cacio e pepe from one of the Italian restaurants.
It's an Italian phrase, and you are what are you the most of? Not generationally or demographically, but what are you the most of? Like, you've got a lot of hats. You've got food in your life from a business perspective. You've got clothing in your life, fashion, shoes. You've got golf. You've got, you know, I'm excited to learn what else you have that I don't know about. But what makes up the most of Buscemi?
Well, I'm a victim of circumstance. I think that's what makes the most of me. I am a product of my environment more than anyone that I know. I grew up in the suburbs of New York City in Uniondale, about a driver away from the New York Nassau Coliseum. And I grew up in a time in New York in the late 70s, early 80s, where it was like, I think I'm a little older than you, but you probably can relate. There was music and art and sports and walls getting broken down in Germany, like all these things happening, you know. And from an early age, you know, the hip-hop skateboard scene in New York was kind of this like underground thing, and I think if you cut me open, you know what I mean, you'd probably see the DNA strain is a lot of skateboarding and hip-hop. That's like kind of the base of me, you know. 6-7 years old, break dancing and listening to music and writing graffiti with my friends. But on the other side, massively into sports as a kid. Played everything, all-star teams, pitched no-hitter in an all-star game when I was in 7th grade.
Even Roger Clemens didn't do that.
Exactly. Played lacrosse at a high level, you know, even walked on at St. John's in 1992, played lacrosse, soccer, baseball, football, skateboarding, like everything, all of it, you know. So I'm kind of like this jock too, you know. But I think all of those things, you know, I was always involved and always interested in the fashion aspect of it, you know. I was always like the best looking guy on the baseball diamond, or in lacrosse I had the, you know, everything I did was kind of like meticulous when it came to like looking good, no matter what situation. The best sneakers, you know, whatever jacket was in fashion, I was always about it. And, you know, we could talk about this for hours, but a big part of my story is in 3rd and 4th grade, we started customizing clothing. We had a store called Shoppers Village in West Hempstead, Long Island, and they had a custom apparel guy there where you could bring your t-shirts and get like stencils or, you know, name of your crew and letters, kind of like that breakdance, kind of like the breakdance crew or the motorcycle club type of vibe.
Right. And this is before you could just go on like some website and get a shirt with whatever you want on it for $15 in 2 days.
Exactly.
This is old school.
It was analog to the fullest. And it was, the biggest thing was to be able to outdo your peers from a fashion standpoint growing up in New York in that time. So
right.
if you all were shopping at Modell's or you were all going to Macy's to buy the latest, you know, polo shirt, that wasn't enough. We had to like take that and then like outdo each other. So the only way to do that was customization and like doing things that were a little bit different. You know what I'm saying?
So I know you and I have been friends for a while. You're currently a member at Wilshire, where that was my home for a long time, and we knew each other a little bit through that and through the community of kind of, I guess, cool golf happenings and whatever in Los Angeles. You know, but we're here now. I realized when I said the word alfresco, I didn't explain where we are alfresco. We could be in Italy, as far as the people listening know. If you're watching the video, this is also a video on YouTube. If you want to look at it, just type in EAL Buscemi, and you'll find it. But the current location is Roosevelt Golf Course, Municipal 9-hole course, right under the shadow of the Griffith Observatory. And you said right before we pressed record that this is where it all began.
That's right. This is where I played my first Well, this isn't an 18-hole course. This is a 9-hole executive, but this is the first time I played a round of golf. It really is. It's a golf course. I mean, if they had another 9 holes, it would be a real golf course. But it's a real golf course. It's an executive 9. In high school, we had golf and PE in sophomore year. So I played for one trimester in Kellenberg. We had a 7-iron and a putter, and we played on the football field. So it was insane.
That's awesome.
We hit off of mats. And then we putt, like, on this fake. It was insane. But we learned how to play golf. I learned how to swing when I was a sophomore in high school. And then when I moved out here in 2002, I moved into my friend Eric Costin's house. He's a professional skateboarder. But he really wants to be a pro golfer. You know that, Eric.
Wow.
That's his dream, you know? So I moved out here, and that's a really long story. But as the story goes, I moved out here to get a job because I was working on Wall Street.
How old are you?
I was 24 at the time.
You were working on Wall Street?
Yeah, I worked on Wall Street for 5.5 years.
Like wearing a suit?
Yeah, suit.
Trading?
Yeah, stockbroker, investment banker.
This is pre-cell phone.
This is pre... No, no. I had a cell phone in 1994, the Motorola gray flip phone.
The massive one.
Yeah.
The one that's the size of like two sleeves of balls.
But in 1990... Exactly.
I mean, where did you put that? In your pocket? Were you early on the man purse?
I was early on the... I was early on the leather backpack.
Ooh.
That was a thing. Like a little leather backpack from like... I don't know who sold it, whatever. It wasn't great.
I had
a black leather backpack.
How much were your shoes at this point in time in your life? How much did they cost?
Well, I made a couple of bucks my second year as a stockbroker, and I think I had a pair of Alden, which were about $500 at the time.
Okay.
Which were a very respectable English, like, Savile Row type of suit shoe. You know what I mean?
Did other Wall Street cats inquire about the shoe?
Well, the thing is, a lot of the Wall Street cats were kind of like those Ginzo, kind of like, hey, you know, they were wearing, like, Alfani. From Macy's, which was like the fake Armani.
Right.
And they had a pair of like Aldos on. What I've learned is money can't buy you taste, you know?
Boom. You know, we're going to get there in a minute. Golf needs your help.
Exactly.
It does.
It really does. So, yeah, I did that. And then I moved out here and these fucking skateboarders were golfing every day.
At Roosevelt.
Golfing, well... everywhere, but this was like the go to breakfast at the pancake place on Sunset. What the fuck is it called? The Griddle.
Hell yeah.
Jump in the car and come here, and I was like, all right, I'll golf. I'll fucking do it.
Wait, and up until this point, you had had, obviously, you seem like the guy that doesn't really tether to one tribe.
No.
Right? You're kind of, like you said, a product of circumstance. So your tribe is merely who you're around. You're great at connecting with people. So I'm imagining that at this point in your life, you have friends with all different types of people.
Absolutely. So there was three tribes in New York, but they were all kind of like...
It's all good.
They were all kind of interconnected through the New York City nightlife.
Right.
So you had us skateboarder kind of art skateboard people, and then you had... the music industry. So we had friends that worked at labels, that worked at the nightclub, that were DJs, that were actual musicians or whatever. And then you just had like socialite crowd that we know about in LA and just people that were always out.
Right.
So those people are always like, I feel like they're making the world go around. You know?
Right.
Usually in any city, it's like the guy that works at the nightclub, he can like make anything happen.
Right.
You know?
Right,
so
right.
We were, those are like the Mike Malvin, Steve Malvin types that were like, had the magazine, the agency, nightlife stuff.
Yeah, just connected.
Just connected people. And those are always nocturnal people, right?
Right.
In a big way. And then moving out to LA, I realized that's where most of things were happening as well.
Right.
So Eric had like a brand new set of clubs, and he had these like clubs that he had won or someone gave them to him, and they were like a set of pings with graphite shafts with like a terrible putter and like... wedges from like, you know, the Roger Dunn like bin, you know.
Right.
So I came out here one day and they were like, wow, I mean, you can swing the club. I said, yeah, I swung the club for one semester in high school. I mean, I guess I can hit a baseball, I can hit this thing. And I just was like immediately hooked that first day being here, because going to a driving range or going to like hit off a mat on a football field is not the same as like, we saw a deer out here. It was like, there was like some cute girls playing. It was like a different experience here, you know?
Coyotes.
So it kind of like got me.
Yeah. This is one of the more natural courses. And we're going to go play and, you know, whatever. Yeah. But this is one of the more natural courses in, like, the world.
Absolutely.
Right? When you really bake it out, it's like, you know, you don't really see... You see more mountains and sky and, you know, nature than you do at a lot of, like, high-end courses.
And one of the best views in the city from 6 or... Yeah, 6. The downhill, the short par 4 downhill, right?
Yeah.
You get that beautiful view. And then the observatory on 7 and 8. Yeah, just imagine playing, like, this is the first place I play golf, and how beautiful it was. Beautiful, man. It still sticks with me, and I was, like, pumped to come here today, man. Thank you.
It's interesting that, you know, like, just real briefly, you know, a big theme for me is, like, are you new to golf, right? Like, let's make sure that those of us that have been around the game long enough are, you know, conscious of what it means to potentially commit your life to the game, whether financially or time or, you know, socially, right? Like, there's that sort of fragile moment in the beginning, and it sounds like you had some Eskimos, some shepherds bringing you in. But, you know, it's interesting because Roosevelt really is that place for a lot of people who aren't ready to play 18, you know, who don't have the time or whatever. And you're probably more likely to see here those memories of people like you and me who say, you know, this is the first place I played golf.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? And you know, and then when you go back and you then have been there for years or decades, and you see, like, wow, like, this place still has that quality to it, and taking care of that and just remembering that. Is that something that, you know, like, does that come across for you or anything like that? Do you think about stuff like that?
Well, I do. And also, I think on the surface here, it looks like this kind of just nine-hole executive in, like, a night. But again, we're in, like, the middle of Hollywood, right next to Griffith's Observatory. I mean, Humphrey Bogart probably played here or something. I don't know the story. But again, I think as everything I go through in life is always these connections. It's like I didn't play the nine-hole executive for the first time in, like, Albuquerque, New Mexico. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's something about, like, this place that has the allure to it. And I think that's what's sticking with me, too. There's a story behind this place.
Yeah.
And also, it's the first time I played 9, and I played it with, like, a couple of really great friends that I was in a weird place in my life, too. I was coming out here to find a job. I was, like, basically broke, didn't know what I was doing in my life. So there's a lot of that's connected to this place.
What's your best round here? Do you remember?
I shot par here. I think I told you. Yeah. Did I tell you that?
No.
Oh, yeah.
That's hard, dude.
Yeah. So if you want to shoot par here, you have to play a hero round, which I did. I had 3 birdies, 1 double, 1 bogey, and the rest pars. I can run you through it if you want me to.
It's okay.
Yeah.
I think maybe people listening aren't going to give too much of a... They won't visualize it.
Yeah.
I want to hear it, though, off camera.
Yeah, off camera, yeah.
The best I have is 1 over, and
yeah,
that's steady.
But how many times have you played here?
Oh, 100.
Okay, yeah, I've played more. I've probably played 200 times here, you know.
You
I played here
stickers.
A lot, dude. I mean, I've only been in Wilshire a year, man.
Right.
You know?
So...
I was hacking around before that, you know.
So,
playing anywhere.
You mentioned a little bit about how skateboarding and golf have a lot in common. I'm curious to know what your thoughts are on that. What do you mean?
I think as a skateboarder, or a skateboarder is like an alcoholic. You're always an alcoholic. You know what I mean?
Boom. Yeah, it's stuck with you.
It's just, it'll always stick with you. I'm always, like, you know, like, skating my fingers on things. Being a skateboarder is in you for life. And I think part of that is it's so tribal. I feel like golf is massively tribal.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I was telling you that one of the things that sucks is if you always notice your tribe at the TSA line has a Titleist hat on. You're like...
It is a familiar sight. even if I don't have a Titleist club.
Exactly.
But, you know, it's true.
But I can't tell you how many times I've been in another country or walking down the street in New York City or wherever or in traffic and you see... Well, let's start in the 80s. In 1989, my brother went to the art school in Pittsburgh, and I was skateboarding. I brought my skateboard. You could tell from 40 miles away that I was a skateboarder with the hat, the hair, the board. And in the 80s, you see another skateboarder down the street. You're like, not only are you best friends immediately, you're family. Like, that's how it feels, you know? And I think golf, I love that about golf. Like, I just had the member guest at Wilshire. Played with 8 dudes that in a million fucking years I would never probably talk to. Just because they golf, I had a great time with them. We have a lot, you know, it's just the... Skateboarding is so fucking hard.
It really is.
And so is golf.
And dangerous.
Golf isn't that dangerous, other than if you're on 9 at Wilshire and some 80-year-old guy hits a drive through the bush when you're on six. It's pretty dangerous.
Can you talk a little bit about, like, you...
But I think it's, yeah, the similarities are, it's so hard. Skateboarding can be done anywhere and in different terrain. Golf is the same way. Every shot is different. Every time you have a skateboard under your feet going down a stair, everything, it's so different every time you're doing those two sports. Like in basketball, there's a rim, here's your boy, you pass it. Baseball, pitch.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like football. It's like those are all kind of like so structured. I think golf and skateboarding aren't, and they have a lot in common. It's so, and the challenge, you know, it's very challenging, you know, compared to, and also you can't get 20 guys to go play football right now.
No.
But you can grab your skateboard and go skate and go grab a club and play. You know, it's like very good like that.
It's interesting because you said, well, I'm harping on this phrase, but a product of your environment. That's kind of both golf and skateboarding have that. You can't really play golf just in an empty field. I mean, you kind of can, but I mean, the game itself is played on a course, and the course is specifically suited to travel. And I've seen skateboarders in every country I've been in, and you know, they are just adapting and finding whatever they have and creatively working within that environment, which is interesting. It seems like that's a creative thing for you.
Absolutely. And also, as a 45-year-old man playing golf, you have the tribe. If you're a 45-year-old ex-football player, you're not going to, like, talk to another football player, like, ever, really. You know what I mean? And I also love skateboard. I mean, you see there's a commercial out right now with, like, 75 or 76-year-old guy who's still, like, skating ramps and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, there's not too many sports you can play at the same level for so long.
Right.
You know, skateboarding, you know, Ron Allen and Lance Mountain that are 55 or 60 years old, they're still skating at the same level that they were at 18.
Right.
It's pretty wild, you know.
You've undergone a transition that most golfers don't go through, which is, am I right that you started off as a muni golfer, public course?
Absolutely.
And then you transitioned into maybe more so playing private courses?
That's right.
And not just private, but I mean exclusive courses. You've had a lot of success. We'll get into your business in the second half of the podcast after the break. But, you know, based around your, you know, great decisions in business and in life, you've had a lot of success, which has afforded you the ability to go play at, like, beautiful golf courses, exclusive golf courses, courses where it's on some level money couldn't even get you there. Can you talk a little bit about, and even your private club membership, right? I mean, because for me, that was a massive transition that mm-hmm. took me a long time to even have the blocks land and for me to figure out even where I was and what it meant and what I was doing and what I could do. And, you know, golf struggles with kind of this high and low. You know, like I get a lot of, you know, feedback on Instagram when I'm at a private course. People say, oh, it's that can't be a hidden gem because it's private. And I don't agree. But I'm also afforded the unique luxury of, I don't even understand. At this point in my golf career, strangely, there is no private course. It's a very strange feeling. I mean, there's a course where I might need to call someone, but more or less could play anywhere. Can you talk a little? It's a weird feeling if you're listening and you think I'm a douchebag. Like, it's a strange experience that I didn't plan for, didn't expect, and didn't really want.
No, but it's inspirational to people listening. You know what I mean?
I mean, I hope so. I hope so. But can you talk about what that's been like for you, is making that transition into this sort of elite world of courses, and you being you, you're an everyman.
Right.
You're not better than anybody, and that's what I really love about you.
That's right.
Can you talk about how that's been and what you've observed and learned?
Well, I feel like I still have an appreciation for the municipal golf and playing really great courses, whether they're private or public. You know, Pebble Beach is a public course, right? You can go play. Anyone can go play it. Maybe you're priced out and you can't go play it. But I think in L.A., and unfortunately, a lot of people maybe won't have access to these private courses or whatever. I feel like the reason I transitioned to a private course was more because of, my lifestyle, right? I can't be, you know, I don't know where I'm going with this. Can we cut this out? I need to start over.
You can start over.
No. Yeah. I feel like as a person, I'm always trying to outdo my peers. That's part of it always.
Interesting.
That's one. In everything I do, when it came to my business as designing shoes, I'm trying to do it better than my friends that design shoes and apparel. When I was a kid skateboarding, I want to do the trick better than you. You know, when I was playing baseball or lacrosse, I wanted to be better. It's just kind of like that out, you know, sportsmanship, trying to outdo
competition.
I'm always in competition, but more importantly with myself. And I felt like being at Wilshire and having a private club membership was like just part of what I wanted to do, just of selfish reasons.
Right.
Hopefully that doesn't sound too douchey, but that's a fucking fact. Like, that's the facts. You know what I mean? That's one. And also, you know, sometimes, you know, playing a 6-hour round at Wilson and Harding is a little difficult on a Friday
complaint.
Afternoon. You know
that's
what I mean?
The
it's like
complaint.
It's really. I mean, I have a few businesses I have to attend to, and I feel like it's almost helping me to be able to be a part of something that like I can like do on my own.
Right.
I can play 13 holes. I can play 3 holes. I can go to the range. You know, it's worth every penny because my time now, where I'm at in my life, is so valuable. Again, not to sound douchey, but every minute is like,
right.
Pretty much.
What about the culture, right? Because we see the culture changing, right? And, you know, like we have friends at all these courses, and we were talking a little bit about how fashion ties into the culture and how that doesn't really matter what kind of course you're on as far as the designation or the
right.
entrance fee or the tee times, or the you know, the greens fee. But, like, just the culture of golf changing a little bit. You and I talked a little bit about, like, our friend Daniel Libman, who may or may not be listening. I don't know if he's a listener.
Shout out to Dan Libman.
Shout out to Libman. But, like, you know, like, we have – Libman and I met at a public course on the driving range, and then years later we were
Rustic
both at
Wilshire.
Angeles. And, you know, we were just grinding out there, just had no home base. And
right.
and that's kind of – in a lot of ways, that's who I kind of try to speak to in a lot of ways, because I know what that feeling is when you're, like, out there – and you don't feel like there's, like, a home base, and you're like, I'll play wherever I got. You know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
And but, you know, as golfers, we kind of need that home base, I think. But as far as the culture changing in I guess, all throughout golf and how fashion relies on that, can you talk a little bit about that, and then we'll take a quick break and circle back?
Absolutely. You know, like I said before, everything I did in my life, and I think maybe I'm, like, the beginning of this, right, when, you know, like – the 80s babies, we'll call it, you know. I feel like style, whether it was Michael Jordan or whoever it was that was kind of took style into sports, whatever that point, that pin is in time, that, you know, guys like Daniel or guys that are 32, 34 years old now, style was always in their life because of their mothers or whatever. It was a culture thing. You know, a guy that's 55 or 60 years old that's at a private club, his mother and his parents probably didn't care. And, like, style didn't matter when it came to sports. And golf is a sport. You know, I feel like it's a point in time now where guys that have the buying power and guys that are want to look good in golf are dying for something. They're like, you know, you have Millar and you have Grayson and you have, you know, Dunhill. You have some of these higher end brands that are kind of getting it, you know what I mean? But it's still not like hasn't like coagulized yet, you know what I'm saying? And I feel like, you know, there's also this kind of street fashion thing that's happening that's trying to find its way into golf because that's a trend thing. So now you have like this old school look, this street kind of urban, like fast, trendy thing. You know, Brooks Koepka wearing off-white Nikes on the course. You know, there's these worlds are colliding. I feel like now there needs to be a change because you have this next tier, this next generation of golfers that are just kind of lost when it comes to the way they look, you know? And you can see it through the pros. You know, you see little hopes of glimmers of life out there, but you still see a bunch of gym teachers out there, kind of, you know, and it's difficult. It's difficult for me to kind of put into words, but I feel like as we move forward, I'm going to try and help that. You know what I mean? That's one of my missions.
You talked a little bit about, you know, the old and the new, and when I see you dressed for golf, I see that, I feel like you try to pull those two together, right?
That's right.
I'll see you with something new that looks old, or something old that looks new, or something old paired with something brand new. And it's refreshing. I mean, you have amazing style.
Thank you.
Is that something that you like? Does it take much thought at this point in your life? I mean, was transitioning into, okay, I need a golf wardrobe, I need a golf closet, has that been challenging, or what have you stuck to?
Actually, you know, when it came to, it was actually, I'm excited about it now because that's really how I inside wanted to look always. A little bit dressed up, but like, I could go to dinner, I could go to a movie, I could go play golf, I can, you know, I can go pick up my son from school. You know what I mean? I wanted that transitional, like, outfit throughout the day. And now, if you see, if I'm going to play golf with a few buddies, they're like, okay, are you going to change? I'm like, no, I'm just leaving. I'm going to go and do what I got to do. You know what I mean? And they're like, okay.
So you wear the golf outfit.
So some buddies I have are like, they have their golf stuff, and then they, like, they have to go change and put their other weird clothes on. You know what I mean? Me, I just want to, I think there shouldn't be any change. I don't think Dean Martin was like, I'm going to go put my golf shit on. You know what I mean? And, you know, he was just in Palm Springs and like, yeah, let's go play golf. That's what it looked like back then. I feel like now it's like, I have to put on my stretch pants. I have to put on my wicking polo shirt. Like, I don't think so. I don't think you have to. I think you can combine those things together. And that's what the newer brands are doing. And that's why I want to help that on the footwear side and hopefully eventually on the apparel side, you know?
All right, well, we're going to get into footwear after this chopper goes by and after a quick commercial. Stand by, everybody. Folks, you've heard me talk about it, and I'm not talking about... Never mind. I'm talking about Precision Pro. You've heard me talk about them. I got a chance to meet these guys. I went out to Cincinnati. I spent 4 years with them in 1 week. It was incredible. Anyway, what's the main thing that golfers have in their bag that they're going to use most during a round? I think you know what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about a putter. I'm not talking about your favorite iron. I'm not talking about your right arm to flag the beverage cart. I'm talking about your rangefinder. All golfers need a rangefinder that they can trust to know the precise distance in their target for nearly every shot, whether you're on the tee box or in the fairway. That's true. I've thought about using it for putting just so I can be super accurate because putting is obviously lagging a little bit. Getting a phone call, folks. Anyway, I carry the NX9 HD rangefinder by Precision Pro Golf. It's easy to use, incredibly fast, and most importantly, it gives me the exact yardage to my target so I can choose the right club and swing with confidence. I actually love pulling it out. People are like, what is that? I'm like, it's Precision Pro. Get down with the green and blue, my guy. Green and gray, I mean. Not to mention, Precision Pro offers free battery replacement services for the life of your rangefinder. We all know how annoying it is to run out of batteries, but you get an extra one when you get it, and then you get rangefinder batteries throughout the, like I said, life of your rangefinder. So you're not only getting a rangefinder, you're signing up for a lifetime service. So really, it just depends on how long you live. And at that point, that's where the podcast sort of, that's where it just drops off, and it's up to you at that point. Live healthy, obviously. Don't play golf in lightning. Don't shoot adventures in golf, because that we've talked about that with my insurance company, and it does decrease my lifespan. But, you know, it increases the benefits, and we all have fun. We've all signed up. Me and the crew have all signed. It's like an NDA for your life. Good news, the NX9 HD rangefinder is on sale for $40 off. Even better, listeners of the podcast can receive an extra $10 off by using the coupon code ERIK, E-R-I-K, at checkout. Go to precisionprogolf.com and use the coupon code ERIK at checkout for $50 off the NX9 HD rangefinder today. Swing with confidence, hit more greens with Precision Pro Golf. All right, got a very, very special read from you. One read that fits into three stripes, because you know how much I love the three stripes, and I'm very excited to share something with you. Who knows what that'll be? Some secrets, maybe? Some secrets in the dirt? No. Adidas took their knit game to a whole new level, and honestly, I wore these just the other day, and I was pretty comfortable and pretty tethered to the ground. Anyway, have you seen the new Tor 360 XT Prime Knit that was just released? It's the first waterproof knit that they've ever had. So what you get there is a lot of flexibility around your little old feet, or big old feet, depending on what size your foot is, obviously. Although your foot may be big in stature, but not so much in, you know, you can have a big foot but still have a small size. You know what I mean? Anyway, they come with a 1-year waterproof warranty and 3 fresh new colorways so you can stand out on the course. It's important to stand out. Sometimes if your golf game... No, anyway. It's built on the XT traction sole, so you get amazing grip, but it's still lightweight and comfortable. That is true. Anyway, head over to adidas.com/US/golf to snag a pair. And follow Adidas Golf on Instagram and Twitter to stay updated on all of their newest releases. Until then, see you out there looking fresh. All right, and we're back. All right, so what we wanted to talk about here is, well, first let's talk about your history with shoes. Your influence on the global world of shoes is large. What do you, when people talk to you about shoes, where do you take that conversation? What do you say?
Well, you know, shoes is a big part of the narrative, man. Almost my whole reason for being here is shoes, period, end of story. And it started at an early age. I bought my first pair of shoes in third grade with money from shoveling snow. And in third grade, I was in 1983, I had like the best pair of shoes I wore in the school. They were Nike Bruins with fat laces and, you know, and then I shoveled more snow or raked more leaves or asked my grandmother for money. Like, I was like, didn't care about anything else but sneakers. So that started at an early age. And then I made a lot of money early in my life, in my early 20s, being a broker, and I bought more shoes and more shoes. And people talk about sneaker heads and sneaker collections and all that shit now, but I had a 200 or 250 piece sneaker collection like before I was 22. You know what I mean? Like, it was weird. I was just like a weird guy with a bunch of sneakers. You know what I'm saying? But and that, when the market crashed and I left Wall Street and I didn't know what the fuck I was going to do, and the first person who told me, you know, once you do something you love, you never work a day in your life. You hear that all the time now, like on Instagram, but when you hear that for the first time, it like took me like a few weeks to like for that to even sink in. So to make a long story short, I parlayed like my knowledge of sneakers and my collection into, I mean, basically lying my way into a job as a designer, kind of like trend forecaster guy at DC Shoes back in the days, you know, in 2002. So with that, I had no fucking clue what I was doing at DC, other than the fact that I knew they weren't doing what was right by the sneaker community. And they wanted to like be a sneaker brand, not just a skate brand. So I got lucky. I worked on a few projects that made a lot of money for DC. I got my PhD in shoemaking, and I left. And, you know, a few years later, I started my own brand. You know, so that was like the, I mean, everything that I've known for, I'm sure on my gravestone will be something about shoes. So now all I care about really, other than my family and having a couple bucks in the bank, is golf. So what else am I going to do? I'm going to make golf shoes, you know? So here I am. I mean, I'm a year into development.
Yeah, but let's dig into greats, though. So you, what made greats so special? What made greats so successful?
Well, I think when Ryan and I came up with the idea to start greats, greats was supposed to be kind of like a camper equivalent. Let's make shoes and sell them in one store, or one store in LA and one store in New York. And then Ryan was like, well, why don't we just do it online? But in 2012, I mean, it's funny, it's only 2019, but 7 years ago, e-commerce isn't what it was now. It was still kind of like, I mean, it was working, but it wasn't as powerful as it was now. It was like, I don't know, we're just going to have a website and sell shoes on it? I don't know, that sounds fucking crazy. But I think it was right when Warby Parker started and right when a few of the big direct-to-consumer brands started, it just was like perfect timing, you know what I mean? And just from the minute we launched, it kind of just got the steamroll. And then it was just a snowball running downhill. And then with all the dawn of the big, you know, direct-to-consumer brands, we were kind of in that conversation, you know, immediately. So I think it was just, again, part of my life. Good timing, good taste, and hard work. Like that, you know, that's luck, right?
That is a good recipe for success right there. It's so interesting hearing your story because it does seem like you just kind of did a back dive into it all. And it's so funny to see here now with, you know, like just such an incredibly happy and successful life. And it's like, huh, Like, you could, it could have gone a lot of different ways.
Absolutely. But also, I'm leaving out all the failure and, like, all the depression and all the hard, and, like, the hard times.
Right.
Because after I left D.C. and I decided to go do this, I had a couple of odd jobs. I worked for Garrett Light's dad, Larry Light at Oliver Peoples, and I, you know, was a brand manager there. And, you know, I consulted and designed shoes for K-Swiss and did some things for Adidas and worked on some things for Nike, just, like, on the side. But at the same time, it's like I have a struggling business. You know, I have a one-year-old son now. I had nothing to lose. It was like we raised a couple bucks and we started Greats, and immediately it caught traction. So I think also you forget, and I'm very lucky that I had this like network around me, this support system, you know. And it goes back to what I told you back in New York City, like the nightclub guy, you know. I was always like the guy that always wanted to have all my dots connected, and I'm always like, I got a guy. I'm like the guy that's got a guy. So like when I start a brand, it's like I got people. Like my friend Kevin Ma started Hypebeast, and my boy David and these guys started High Snobiety and all the blogs and the press, and my friend owns a press company. Like I always knew that these people would like. And people like me, I like them. And if you're going to start a brand, you need press. That's it, man. You know, that's the game now.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of good friends. Thank you, friends.
So you're coming out now. The next fold is golf shoe. That's, I mean, the general shoe market is a little bit more wide open, I would say. You probably had a little bit, you know, more room in your lane probably to just open and grow and hit some traction and hit a stride there. Mm-hmm. Golf is obviously a niche, and a lot of times I feel like I'm in a niche within a niche. Do you at some point, like, how do you, where are you at now? Like, do you care about that, or are you just like, I'm making a shoe, and at what point is it like the shoe and then transcends into the sale or
right.
whatever?
So every time I've done something in my career, especially when I've started a brand, I have a twist. Unfortunately, I can't talk about this twist on this microphone today. I could talk to you off microphone, and everyone will know it when I come back in 6 months, hopefully. But I know how to make shoes very well. That's a fact.
I love that.
I was at Augusta during the Masters, and Sean Foley called me Boosh from the driving range. You know what I mean? Like, Claude Harmon and I are friends, and I know you, and me and Ricky Fowler text each other about, like, what he's wearing to his wedding. So I'm, like, I'm in the golf world now. Like, I'm somehow in it, like, and because it's a niche and it's just like skateboarding, it's very kind of like this small thing. But through, I got to shout out Steve Malbin for, like, bringing me into the light 3 years ago. But now I know I can make shoes. I have friends and allies in this world. Now I have to bring you the twist. And the twist is, I can't talk about it, but just wait for it.
Well, without revealing the twist, which I'm very excited to have it be revealed to me once we turn the mic off.
Right.
What, have you learned anything yet? Have you had any challenges so far with making a golf shoe?
Well, I've learned.
Because it's a challenging move.
Right. What I've learned is in any industry, whether it's my hot sauce brand, the deli, you know, StockX, which I'm an investor in, the whiskey brand that me and a few friends started, if you don't have something that people are going to think that's better or different than what they already have, then don't do it at all. So I can make shoes very well. I know people in the golf industry. I just need to have the twist. I think golf shoes, believe it or not, after researching them for a year, very, very strenuously, are not much different than a regular shoe I've already made. So that's a good thing.
We got to turn the mics off and talk more about this. We're going to go play golf. What's your golf mindset? What do you get on the golf course?
Golf, what I get on the golf course about twice or three times around is a feeling of greatness that you can't get anywhere else. Whether it's the first time you had sex or the first time you did a drug or the first time you did anything that made you feel really good, you can get that at least once around. And that's why I'm out here today. Or you want something specific?
No, I like that. That was
just
a great answer.
Puring my Callaway 18 degree, the weapon, which I call it.
Murder.
You'll hear it on the first tee here. I'm going to hit it onto the fringe.
What do you think, like, the point of golf is? I mean, because we literally spend hours, days, weeks, months, years of our lives sort of chasing this game and understanding it and playing it and enjoying it.
The point of golf for me is it's something that I can do exactly like the best guy in the world. I can beat Tiger on the seventh hole at Wilshire any day of the week. And that's a fact. Straight up, I can beat him on 135-yard par 3. Right?
Right.
I can't beat Deion Sanders or... That's a bad reference. Or fucking...
Old school.
Right.
Barry Bonds.
Yeah. I can't hit a home run like Barry Bonds. I'll probably never be able to do it. But I think for me, inside, I'm very competitive, and I think I'm the best in the world at what I do in my daily life. I think golf affords that luxury to anyone who has the mind state to think that way. You know, you can do you could be better than the best person on the planet at any given time, any given day.
What do you hate
about golf?
In life, everything, general.
What do I hate? I don't hate many things, but I hate people with bad attitudes more than anything. I think there's a lot of people with bad attitudes in this world. Well, maybe for right reasons, but in my life, I like to have PVO, you know, the positive vibes only. I really hate people that that come from a place of the bad energy kills me. That's the thing I hate the most in this world, the bad energy.
What are you afraid of?
The thing that I'm afraid of the most is my son, bringing my son up. That's always like the only thing I'm really scared about every day is like looking at my kid and saying, am I doing the right thing here? You know what I mean? Like being a good parent. That's the scariest thing I've ever done in my life. I don't think it's ever going to stop. Having a kid is, you always hear, I mean, my dad always used to say, you're going to see when you have kids. And I know that feeling really well, man. I know that feeling really well.
How do you want to die?
Well, now, it's funny. I mean, I would say this in any podcast. It's probably be either in a bed with a beautiful woman or on the golf course somewhere. Somewhere.
Sounds very James Bond of you. What do you like to do on the golf course? Do you like to gamble? You're a better, right?
To
gamble?
I like to gamble within reason. Like, you know, we have a couple guys at Wilshire that you've played with recently that...
They go big.
Yeah. Which I'm... Look, I have a couple of bucks, but I don't feel comfortable betting a ton of money.
What's
on the
your
golf
max
course.
Wager you like to go for?
You know, once things get up to $100 a hole, I think that's where I'll stop.
That's a lot.
It's pretty much a lot. But I like to start out if someone wants to do, you know, $10 a hole, you know.
So that's so
auto presses after two down, you know, that type of thing. It gets hairy, man. You're not playing well.
Let's do it. I'm not, as people watching might know, I'm not the best. I don't perform too well under pressure on the golf course, but we should try it.
Yeah, let's do a small wager.
Okay, so 10 a hole.
10 a hole.
I can most I can lose is, well, 90, but then I guess we could press.
Yeah.
But I don't have to lose every hole.
You won't lose every hole.
What's your handy? We play handicaps.
Yeah, we'll play handicaps.
You're what?
I'm a 12. My index is 12, so maybe you'll give me...
And I'm a 5.
Yeah.
4-7. So that means 7. So that was, you would get 3 or 4 strokes.
Okay.
Right?
That sounds right.
Because it's half, because it's 9.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you shot even here, my best is 1 over. I mean, you got maybe course knowledge, confidence.
That's why you shot an 84 at Proghorn, because you're a 4.
Yeah. What do you mean?
No, because you guys had a 84, and I was like...
Oh, it was so bad.
I thought you were like a 6 or an 8 or something.
We're not. We weren't like...
You're a 4,
I didn't have the right handicap to play in the event.
No. Yeah.
Buscemi's talking about the Jones Weekender where we just were.
Shout out to Jones.
Jones is great. The slides you did with Jones are great. Those nice, those are leather.
Yeah, it's a leather slide. It's more for, you know, getting the newspaper on the driveway or, you know, shuffling around the house.
They're clean.
Yeah, they're good.
We do a lot. I love working with Jones. Those guys, you know, and really as we kind of let's dive back into the whole, like, you know, your endeavor, which is going to be your name, right? It's going to just be called Buscemi?
Yeah, it's going to be called Buscemi Club Special.
Sick. You know, this is sort of the dawn, right, of smaller companies coming in, making a difference, making an impact, offering choice and creative expression to the golfing community that otherwise was relegated to a Titleist hat.
That's right. That's right.
Absolutely. That's important.
Right. It is. It is.
What is, you know, when you look at, to dive back into that Proust questionnaire thing, you know, what do you love?
What do I love? I mean, I love my family. I love that I have the opportunity to be able to now, you know, after grinding it out for so many years, I have the opportunity to pick whatever lane I want to be in. Before, you know, I had to work hard to get to this position, but,
right.
You know, and I tell this to, you know, entrepreneurs that come up to me or people that come up to me, like, how did you get here? You know, I got here because I worked my fucking ass off for other people for a long time and took my lashes, you know what I mean? I love that I did that because I have friends, you know, hopefully they're not listening to this, you know, but I have friends that are still like doing the same thing in my town that had the opportunities of a lifetime that just kind of like wasted it, and I didn't, you know? And I think I love that I have an opportunity to do exactly what I want to do because I worked hard to get it, you know? I love that, you know?
So, right.
I do.
Favorite type of food? Favorite dish?
Favorite dish.
Because it's Italian is your favorite type of food.
Italian's my favorite food, but I'm you know what? That's slowly changing, man.
Whoa.
It's slowly changing.
Moving to what?
Well, I mean, I feel like I'm changing a little bit to more Asian, the Asian palate.
Interesting.
You know what I'm saying? I've been eating a lot more, and especially like I've been eating at this Malaysian restaurant called Sticky Rice downtown. It's in the Grand Central Market. It's one of the best meals you can ever have.
But, okay.
So my favorite dish right now is the chicken and rice from Sticky Rice downtown.
I'll check it out.
Check it. It's amazing. It's chicken marinated, barbecued, with this like relish on the side with sticky rice. Have you ever had sticky rice?
Yeah,
it comes
yeah.
in a bag.
Yeah. Oh, kind of sweet.
It's a little sweet with the coconut milk on it,
yeah.
And then you have the charred marinated chicken on top.
My favorite is the Thai dessert, the melon and the rice.
Oh, the melon and the rice.
The yeah. Mango.
Mango sticky rice. I mean, come on, man.
Dude.
It's pretty good.
I fall asleep immediately because there's a lot of sugar. But
number one is pizza, I think, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm still there.
Do you have a pizza oven at the house?
I do have a pizza oven in the house.
I have
a wood-burning pizza oven, 48-inch pizza oven in the back of my house, all wood-burning. You have to use citrus woods, orange. You have to use lemon wood. It has no smoke, so your pizza doesn't get smoky. So remember that, listeners. Citrus wood.
Dude, let's go play some golf.
Let's do it.
Thank you for being a guest on the show. I really appreciate it. Buscemi, you're on Instagram. It's just, it's J-O-N Buscemi, right?
That's right. B-U-S-C-E-M-I.
Yeah. And, check out Greats. Check out the shoe coming out.
Yeah.
Check out, Uncle Paulie's.
Check out Uncle Paulie's. Check it out. I'm Beverly.
Best sandwich shop. What's the go-to there?
Italian combo or the Paulie, which is a turkey, fresh made mozzarella and roasted pepper.
What's going to be the next thing? What's after the golf shoe?
I don't know, man. We're just going to stay here for now. We're going to focus. It's going to be hard work. You know the golf world. You know, there's 3,000-4,000 stores I got to go visit, you know? So it's hard to.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with that.
Thanks, man. I can't wait
to see the product, and I don't know, let's go play some golf. Let's go lose some money. Hopefully we lose the same exact amount.
Exactly. I'll win on the Aloha.
Thanks, man.
Later, man.